Once again, this is Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 18, entitled The Perfection of Renunciation, and this is text number 40. There is no being existing, either here or among the demigods in the higher planetary systems, which is freed from these three modes born of material nature. Please repeat, there is no being existing. Either here or among the demigods in the higher planetary systems, which is freed from these three modes born of material nature. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The Lord here summarizes the total influence of the three modes of material nature all over the universe. This is a very short, we might say it's a deceptively short purport, because although it's entirely one sentence long, it's a very, very, very deep idea. And Prabhupada rightly points out, he follows from originally from the commentary of Sridhar Swami, via the commentaries of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladeva Dabhushan, the idea that this verse is actually summing up all the discussion that we've been having over the last several days, actually, about the influence of the three modes of material nature. Most recently, where have we found that influence? There are five things that Krishna has dilated on, the influence of the three modes, in five ways. On the action that's going on the person who's performing that action, or the agent through which it's being done, on the, what is it, jnanam, on the awareness of the action, and what else? He mentioned dhriti, the determination within that action, sukha, the result of happiness or distress from that action. These are five ways in which everything that we do and everything that happens, not only in this world, but even in, well, it's stated here, divideveshu vapuna, prithivyamva, earth, sky, or heaven, everything that goes on. And that's a very, very important point. That's the idea here, that the acharyas are telling us, that summarizes means that he wants to indicate that this is a universal phenomenon. The influence of these modes is working everywhere. So much so that there is nothing that exists, there is no being, no existence. Sattva means existence. Sat comes from the Sanskrit verbal dhatus, us, which means to be. And sat means, therefore, to exist. Sattva means the state of that existing, existence. There is no existence, literally translating it. There is no existence that is not influenced by these three modes of material nature. Other acharyas have pointed out here that when we talk of sattva, we mean not only living beings, we also mean inanimate things. Conversations, for example, cars, for example, foodstuffs, for example, music, for example, everything that you can think of can be categorized in these three modes of material nature that Krishna has been dilating on with regard to the activity, the performer of the activity, the awareness within the activity, the resultant happiness and distress from that activity, the determination that is associated with that activity. These are five ways, but this verse is actually very important because it tells us that this thing is actually applicable universally, in everywhere, with everyone, in all things. That is why we find the importance of Sankhya philosophy, because Sankhya philosophy takes this understanding and tries to chalk out a program of activity or determination or awareness or happiness or action or disciplined performer in such a way that we become elevated ultimately to the state of Gyan. In the beginning of this chapter, just like in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is here reiterating to Arjuna the importance of ritual action. That's called karma, better known as dharma. Yajna, sacrifice especially. And the reason being that that kind of activity purifies one's mind, purifies one's heart, purifies one's consciousness, citta. To the extent that one actually can accommodate knowledge or maintain knowledge or act in knowledge. That's important because we may have experienced that we may know what to do, but we may not want to do it, even though we know we should. We may know what we should not do, and we do not refrain from that, even though we know it's wrong. This is the famous line that we find in the Mahabharata from Duryodhana, who said, "Janami dharmam nacha me pravritti." I know what is dharma, but I just can't stay engaged in that way. "Janami adharmam nacha me nivritti." I also know what is adharma, what is, we might say, irreligion. I mean, that's a poor translation for adharma, but it's a working one. And yet, he said, I can't refrain from that. This is a circumstance that we find ourselves in on a daily basis, isn't it? On a moment-to-moment basis, as a matter of fact. Because what is life but a series of consecutive choices lined up, one after the other? That's what time is. That's all it is. You have to make a decision. Every minute is a junction. Am I going to use this minute to take myself up, or am I going to use it to take myself, or even worse, others, down with me? Just like in Vrindavan, there's a nice billboard out on the street, you can see. I forget just exactly what the jingle was associated with this advertisement, but it's Florence Apartments in Vrindavan, conjuring up a very non-vraja image in the mind of the mental speculator who's contemplating that object of the senses. So you can live in this nice apartment and forget all about Vrindavan. I mean, that's really the subtext, but it has to remain subtextual, because if they make it explicit, then it becomes a very blatant aparadha, and that's, of course, against all social sensibility here. That's about as bad as what we heard about this morning, the cell phone and the Gucci jeans and whatever the one of the Pujaris tried to dress Bhakti Bihari one day. It doesn't really work so well. But it's possible that that can ultimately work one day, and that's why we have to be careful about monitoring our association and monitoring the choices that our mind is making at every moment. And always being alert. This is what we learn in the fifth canto, in the discussion between Jarbharat and Maharaj Rahugana. Do not ever, ever trust your mind. Never. Even if you're a Paramahamsa, even if you're Prabhupada, or nowadays they have Prabhupada, this idea is going about as well. So, I mean, it doesn't really matter. The mind must never be trusted. And the program of Samkhya is to take that mind and to somehow or other leash it to the intelligence, the discriminating intelligence, such that the intelligence can actually categorize everything in its proper place. And Krishna is allowing us, in chapters 17 and 18 in particular, to see these connections, to connect all the dots between this and what has gone before in the Bhagavad Gita, but in a very practical way, so that we can understand karya karya. Karya karya vijanatah, as he told us in chapter 16. Ultimately, the most simplistic way to approach this is in an authoritarian mode. If you look at the word shastra, what does shastra mean? It comes from the dhatu shas, and shastra means a weapon. It pulverizes you into submission with what we call chodanas, orders. There's no choice about it. The Shastra contains, according to the Purvam Mimamsa school, Shastra contains nothing, well, very little of significance other than vidhis and nishedhas, do's and don'ts. Do this, don't do that. When it's a question of getting something very important done, there's no time for the mind. There's no time for poetry. There's no time to appease the sentiments. There's no time for emotions. Just do it. When the building is burning down, there's no time to placate egos, even though there may be a need on another occasion. So this whole world is burning, actually, as we learn from Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. It's actually like that. It's like a burning forest fire, and in whatever language you have to communicate the message, which is to get out. Get out now. Tamal Krishna Goswami, way back in the 70s, there was a famous Mayavadi book called Be Here Now. You may have read this one. I don't know if the author is dead now or not, but Be Here Now, that was the philosophy. And ultimately, of course, you may have guessed, it was ultimately aimed at Mayavad, whatever. So Tamal Krishna Goswami countered with his own proposition, which was, get out now. Instead of being here now, we want to get out now. That's the ultimate intention of a civilized human being who pursues in human form of life four goals. What are those four goals, civilized human beings? We call them chatupurusharthas, fourfold human goals. The first one is dharma, and dharma is itself something that snags most of us for life, because we just don't have a clue and never really get one. So especially in this Kali Yuga, it's pretty hard to get out of that morass. But if you somehow or other figure it out and play your cards right, then through dharma you get facility. And facility is called artha. You are facilitated. You get all the assets that you require, you get all the instruments you require, you get, you know, especially that comes down to money. Practically speaking, especially here in India, that's the realization. It's all about money. And then, of course, money is useful because with money you can fulfill your desires. That's called kama. Now, we're not stating whether these desires are material or spiritual. It doesn't really matter. The mechanics are identical in either case. Whether you're dealing with yoga maya or mahamaya, you're dealing with desire. And you're dealing with activities that follow from it. And you're dealing with dhriti, or determination, which is meant to fulfill it. And you're dealing with happiness or distress that results from it. That we've just heard in the last 3, 4, 5 verses. The results of happiness and the mode of goodness are, who remembers? It's like, yeah, it's very unpleasant, actually, in the beginning. It's like karela. If you eat karela, you have to eat that first to stimulate the digestion. And it's not really that, it's not as pleasing as a gulab jamun, karela. Right? Karela at the end of a meal is just not going to work. But if a person, and especially for Western tongues, or even in places other than Bengal, people are not really so fond of bitter tastes, but If you take it every day, gradually karela becomes very fond of it. So that's, I mean, a crude example, but mode of goodness, happiness is like that. Shreyas in general is like that. It's very difficult in the beginning, but it becomes like nectar in the end because it elevates us, it ennobles us, it enlightens and expands our consciousness, and allows us to see things that we could not see otherwise. It has that very subtle depth to it and worth. So therefore, things that are ancient, they have withstood the tests of time. They're generally of this sattvic character. And then happiness in the mode of passion, we know it's like nectar in the beginning. That's called treyas, the immediately appealing thing. But it usually stings you in the end, in one way or another. And happiness in the mode of ignorance, unfortunately, it really doesn't happen. it's just bewilderment and misery and frustration from beginning to the end because the person has no vision whatsoever. So, anyway, I don't want to get too much off the track here, but the idea is that Krishna has been elaborating on the importance of understanding how the modes of material nature permeate all existence and how they permeate all beings. Everyone you speak to, and even those who cannot speak, like the animals or the insects or the germs, such as viruses, they're all impelled by these three modes of material nature. They all impact us in a certain way that in turn may impel us to go into a certain mode of nature. That's why the intelligence has to be cultivated. And that's the unique prerogative of the human form of life. And so a person who has disciplined himself or herself and followed dharma can be elevated to the platform of real awareness, in which one is awake to these realities, and one is cultivating this awareness as well, because it is hard work. It's like maintaining a relationship. Over 50% of the marriages in modern society, anywhere you go, including India, maybe especially in India, they end in divorce because people don't realize that it's not just a question of autopilot. You have to work on it. So actually, if you think about it much more widely than just interpersonal relationships, dharma means the science of all interrelationships, both animate and inanimate. It's all governed by ubiquitous principles, metaphysical principles of that manifest in a tangible way, or at least in a semi-tangible way, the laws of nature. That's called Ruta in the ancient Vedic language, the coursing of the universal order. And it later came to be identified as dharma. So when we think of the word dharma, we have a very, generally a shallow concept, because we kind of have to translate it in terms, like I said earlier. Religion is one way to translate it. Duty is another way. Obligation, perhaps. Intrinsic property or nature of a thing is a fourth way to do it. There are many ways to translate this word, because the one word means all of them at once. And we can't be consistent about how we translate it, because there is no English word that subsumes all the meaning that we want. The reason no English word exists is because no English concept exists that requires that word, because it's not been cultivated. Therefore, where does dharma actually inhere if not in the society itself, not in the individual, nor in his realizations, nor even in the shastras? It must inhere only in the society itself. The society itself is the locus of dharma, the adhishtana, we might say in Sanskrit. The anushtana. Anushtana means the custom or the traditional practice or discipline that is meant to associated with dharma. And adhishtana is the place in which this occurs. So the adhishtana of the anushtana. Sthana means place. They're all locative concepts. It's the society itself. Therefore, I often say that it takes one generation of neglect only to wipe out millennia worth of cumulative wisdom, cumulative culture, knowledge, disciplines, science, technology, practical things. Just like in India, we have what we call gharelu ilaj, home remedies. If you've studied Ayurveda, you may know. What do you do when you've got a headache? People used to know these things. Now they don't know them because it takes one generation. All you have to do is sleep at the wheel for one generation and the whole thing's gone in a particular place. Therefore, we're very fortunate because Prabhupada has gone all over the world and he's planted these seeds all over the world. And they're sprouting because there is sincerity all over the world. And when it reaches a critical mass, it begins to, the piety that is produced from bhakti itself begins to manifest, and these things will also begin to manifest. We'll see that. Prabhupada wanted this to happen. And we can see. There are signs of it already. So, I didn't really get to make my point, but I was going to say that the purpose of Sankhya philosophy is to, first of all, discriminate very carefully and to weed out what is elevating from what is degrading in the human form of life. To weed out especially what is real as opposed to unreal. Now, how do we know the difference according to Bhagavad Gita? If you've studied chapter 2, you should know this.
The real is permanent.
Sorry?
The real is permanent.
What's the verse? Anybody know? I'm thinking of a particular verse. In Sanskrit. Just now I'm myself and having a senior moment. That's why I'm asking. Nasate vidite bhavo na bhavo vidite sata. Again, we have the word sat. So sattva, existence, beingness, is another way to translate. Beingness. So sattva, that which really has existence, or us, that thing cannot decay, cannot disappear at any time. And that thing which cannot sustain, that's not real. So if you think you're Krishna conscious, and then you have some problem, and some degree of your Krishna consciousness is erased, or at least double-clicked, you know, then you have to consider, do I really have a mature realization? Just like someone asked Prabhupada this question once, can a person change his rasa? And Prabhupada said, yes, why not? Now, rasa is supposed to be an eternal thing. So the logical conclusion would be that, well, the person hasn't really realized his ontological status, that is to say, his sarup siddhi. That's another matter I don't want to get into too much. But Sankhya philosophy has this ultimate project of separating matter from spirit, separating what's real from what's unreal, through the use of intelligence, mainly. And there is a practical element as well. I mean, we can divide the six darshans into three triads, into one triad, I should say, three pairs. The Purva Mimamsa and Uttara Mimamsa, that means the Karma Mimamsa school and the Vedanta school, they go together in that they're both using their discrimination to find out what is the maximum benefit of the human form of life. One looks at karmic results within the paradigm of karma only. The other one looks at jnana results outside of the karma paradigm and within this realm of spirit. Or at least what the Germans might call Geistheit, subtle things. So, then you've got Nyaya Vaisheshika, which is your means of looking at things. How do you, it's all about Praman for them. How do you know things at all? They get locked up in that concern. And then you've got the Sankhya and the Yoga school. I've already discussed what Sankhya does, ultimately what its ideal is. The way that they achieve this is through the practical application. Practicum. Lab. That's called yoga practice, especially Ashtanga yoga. And ultimately the idea is to come to the same stage of samadhi. Dhyanavastitatadgatena manasa pasyanti yam yoginaha. Srimad Bhagavatam says. So, this is the importance of understanding the ramifications of this little verse in the Bhagavad Gita that has a one sentence purport. It's pointing to a much more comprehensive universe of concern, all of which is dominated by the three modes. So try to understand the massive, massive influence of these three modes. Even demigods, because we've described already, it's in heaven too. They get bewildered by tamoguna sometimes. Brahma chased after his own daughter, did he not? Who else was it? He kidnapped Tara. Who was this, the moon god or somebody? I forget now. Brihaspati? Anyway, there's so many. You think there are scandals in ISKCON. It doesn't stop. Anyway, So this is the general scheme here in this first verse, text number 40. And then, now it's very interesting that Krishna has, in the next few verses, up until 45 or so, he's chosen to focus his message a little bit more. On what level? He starts talking about what? Varnashram Dharma. Why is he talking about, of all the things that he could have said, since he's just told us that every existence, every entity, every being, living or non-living, is being pushed and pulled by these three modes of material nature, so why would he shift gears and take us into Varnashram? Of all the possible avenues to explore in this discussion, why is he going here? Say this louder, please.
Varnashram Dharma is the way we can regulate our activities in order to elevate us.
Because Varnashram Dharma is the way to regulate our activities in order to elevate us, and specifically Sridhar Swami has mentioned on this verse, the way that that activity elevates us is through knowledge. One gains adhikar for knowledge only through sadachar. Sadachar means basically dharma. Karmic behavior. You cannot process the instructions that you receive from a pure devotee if your character is bad. It will not happen. You will misinterpret. You will reject. You will accept selectively. You will do any number of things impelled by these three modes of material nature. Therefore, the heart or the consciousness, at least the intelligence, has to be purified through gyan, but the adhikar for that gyan is good behavior. Traditionally, and it's important to just bookmark this word tradition because I'm going to return to it in a moment. Traditionally, the prerequisite for Vedanta study amongst all the acharyas, whether personalist or impersonalist, the prerequisite is that you have to have assimilated sadachar. That means dharma. You have to have some idea. Therefore, in Vedanta is called Uttara Mimamsa, later Mimamsa. The Karmakanda school is called Purva Mimamsa, earlier Mimamsa. Why? Because Jaimini, the author of the Purva Mimamsa Sutras, he begins his work with Atato Dharma Jignyasa, not Atato Brahma Jignyasa, because there's no Brahma Jignyasa without Dharma. Dharma comes first. That's a very, very important point. Now, that's one reason I won't deny that, that Krishna is mentioning, of all the things that he could have mentioned, he switches topics and starts talking about Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras at this point, because when one follows this Varnashram system, that is really, in effect, what distinguishes the human being from the animals, and also the human being from the godly human being from the demoniac human being. We've read that before in chapter 16, or we should have. Shastra Vidhanoktam, what is stated in Shastra, is the basis on which we discriminate between what we'll do and what we'll not do. Again, this goes back to the verbal root of Dharma Shastra. Dharma, the word Dharma, Driyate, Sa Iti Dharma. That thing which sustains you is called dharma. In shastra, we've already discussed, that thing which commands you is called shastra. So you're given commandments in the dharma shastra that tell you how to sustain life. Now, a very interesting little factoid here that not everyone is aware of is that the medical literature and the artha shastra and the or Niti Shastra rather, and the Dharma Shastra, they're all interconnected. I mean, almost inseparably interconnected, to the extent that the authors of the Dharma Shastra very often commented on Ayurvedic works as well. To what extent? They actually improve on Ayurvedic works, in that when there's a particular branch of medicine being discussed, the Dharma Shastrakars will go back to the original Purana from which that idea has been gleaned, and it will quote it in the commentary. They're all very interconnected. Therefore, it's significant that what is the title that we give to the medical science, Indian medical science, coming from the Vedas. What is it called? Ayurveda. And what does Ayu mean?
Life.
And Veda means?
Life.
Understanding how to live. If you understand how to live, then you understand how to sustain. You see the connection? They're very much connected. And of course, statecraft is particularly important for the leaders of society because they've got to give directions to everyone else. We were having some discussion recently about why there's not so much mention. I won't go here because those are the subject of the coming verses. I don't want to spoil the plot. But I don't need to, because there's enough to mention here alone. But the idea is that one reason that Krishna begins to discuss Varnashram at this point, after having illustrated at such great length the importance of understanding how the modes operate amongst us and upon us, then he goes into Varnashram. One reason is that we all need to elevate ourselves and cultivate an awareness of what human life can offer us and how to sustain it, how to live, and how to get the most out of it. But it goes a little further also, and I told you earlier to bookmark the word tradition. The reason is, as I mentioned earlier, the actual location of this dharma, this abstract concept from which the activities emanate, it must be only in the society. It can only really be fully embodied in the society. That's why we have such voluminous epics, such as especially Mahabharata and Ramayana. More than any other shastra, they actually show you how people live in Vedic culture on a day-to-day basis in very great detail and practical day-to-day sort of illustrations are given there in the stories. To some extent also, of course, it's there in the Bhagavatam because Bhagavatam is the essence. But it's really, it's expanded version on that aspect, on the social aspect of Vedic realization. It's found in the Mahabharata, the epics in general. And I mentioned earlier that it takes only one generation of neglect of this factor to wipe it out. So that means that throughout human history, with every generation, this thing has to be somehow assimilated, imbibed, and manifested in such a way as to teach the coming generations. It has to happen in every generation. You cannot allow a single generation to go by without really fully getting that point. Otherwise, the thing will be deleted. And this is why I think in Bhagavad Gita, just before Krishna says this famous verse, yad yad acharati shreshtas tatadevi tirojanaha, whatever a great man performs, common men follow, and whatever standards he sets by exemplary acts. What is the word used there? Pramanam kurute. You make a pramana. You create a pramana. Now we know from philosophy, pramana means that thing by which you prove something, by which you understand the thing. It's your evidence, your authority. And Krishna says here in chapter 3 that the pramana is the person who is the leader of the society. If there is a person who is the locus of dharma, it is the authority within that society. But in general, the most comprehensive concept of dharma means it must be manifested in the society as the society. Now, in my understanding, this is why in the 11th canto, I think it's chapter 19, text 17, or maybe it's chapter 17, text 19, I always get them mixed up. Krishna says, Shruti pratyaksham aitihyam anumanam chatushtayam. He says we have four pramanas. Do we learn this in Srila Prabhupada's books, that there are four pramanas? No, we don't. We learn of three pramanas, is it not? We learn of Anuman, we learn of Pratyaksha, and we learn of Shabda. That means, respectively, guesswork, sense perception, or authoritative assertion. But Krishna is listing a fourth one. What is the fourth one that he mentions? Aitihya. Anybody have any clue? You probably don't. It's a very rare word in Sanskrit. Aitiha means traditional precedent. In legal terms, we call it that. Legal precedent. And Dharma Shastra is also, if you go to Mathura, you go to Courthouse Road in Mathura and look at the courthouse building, what does it say there? Anybody seen it? It says Dharmalaya, the house of law, because Dharma also means law. So legal precedent is called aitihyam. Or historical precedent, social convention, custom, maybe tradition, all these things more or less are subsumed within the idea. But Krishna says that this is another praman, because especially when we get into the realm of dharma, there is no other praman. If you look in the dharma shastras themselves, and how many are there? 2,000 or more. And even with that voluminous body of writing, you cannot find the detail that matches the circumstance that you're looking for. I know, because I'm engaged in such research at the moment. We're looking for evidence on various kinds of guru issues, we can say. So it's just not so common. And this is why. I know this not only from studies of the Dharma Shastra or from any other Shastra for that matter. It's like this in music, it's like this in metrics, whether in the vernacular or in Sanskrit. What the Shastra says is one thing. It's a very faithfully received body of wisdom, and it's very faithfully passed on, but the real thing is in the hands of the gurus who are teaching it. And you cannot get that picture just from the Shastras alone. It has to come from the gurus, or, as I said earlier, the best picture, the whole picture, is the society itself. But at least those who are Shrestha, Krishna says, since whether they like it or not, they are going to determine the Pramana. They are going to become the de facto Pramana for the next generation. Therefore, they have to be careful. And the context in which he said that, he made that statement also, is very significant. Because he says there in chapter 3 also. Karma naiva hi sam siddhim asthita janakadayah loka sangraham evapi sampashyan kartam arthasi. That's the last thing he said before he emphasized the importance of the Shrestha doing it. So what does it mean? Kings such as Janaka attained perfection solely by performance of prescribed duties. Therefore, if only, or just for the sake of educating the people in general, you should perform your work. You must do this, Krishna says. Another nice reference that's in the same spirit follows in the next chapter, text 15 of chapter 4, where Krishna says, evam jnatva, knowing this, kritam karma puravayerabhi mumokshubhihi. Those who are really serious about liberation, they do exactly as the Kuravas did, exactly as those who went before him. Whatever they did, that's what they follow. Kuru karmaiva tasmat vam. Therefore, you should do only your karma. Purvaihi purvataram kratam. Just as it was done by generations of ancestors. Now, this is an interesting concept, because this is something that is actually echoed throughout all the Dharma Shastras, and especially in the Manusmriti. And it resonates very well with the quote from the 11th canto that I just told you about, wherein Krishna tells Uddhava that tradition itself is another kind of praman. Manusmriti, for example, he says that, particularly regarding any question of doubt as to how to perform one's prescribed duty, or what should be a social standard, for example, he says that exactly as one's forefathers or predecessors have done, that thing you should do to the letter, very, very strictly. Do not deviate at all. If you follow like this, then you will never go wrong. The implication of that verse is that if you do something else, then you may go wrong. But this is the fearless and doubtless way, I should say, of maintaining this idea intact. It's a very, very important thing. This, in my view, it explains the extreme conservatism that has always characterized Hindu culture generally, and Orthodox Vedic culture in particular. Very, very conservative. To what extent is the Hindu culture or Vedic culture extremely conservative? I'll give you an example. When I was in college, history, we were studying, there's one history book, and it's stated there that they have found shards of pottery from about 3,000, maybe 3,000 years ago, or more, 3 or 4,000 years ago in the Punjab Valley, around Kurukshetra, that area. And those, you know, they're just the same shape as the lotus that you can buy right now in Loi Bazaar. Or they found, you know, broken pieces of these glass bangles that they still sell right across the street here. Chudiyan, women still wear them. That is what I call cultural continuity. And that is a very good example of the kind of extreme conservatism that we see as part of Vedic civilization in general. There's a principle behind it. This is the point. And that principle is dharma. And just as the Vedas have been very carefully, very, very carefully preserved over so many generations, at least 3-4 millennia, if not 5 or more. I mean, actually, we say they're eternal, don't we? But, I mean, how do they, does anybody know about Vedic recitation? How they actually teach the Vedas and memorize the Vedas? They memorize the text verbatim, the entire thing. They also memorize it backward. They also rearrange the words and memorize that. They take, you know, padapath, they call it. They take portions of the text and put it in a certain order and memorize that, just to function as a check and balance system such that this thing cannot be lost under any circumstances. That's Vedic recitation. Of course, that's not entirely central to the need of a devotee who wants to become Krishna conscious, but it's taken very seriously in the Purva Mimamsa school. And, you know, it's the only reason, really, that we have the Vedas today. Somebody took that kind of care. It makes you wonder about the freedom with which we edit our own books, for example. But I don't want to get too much into that. I think the main thing here in this verse, before we go on, is that Krishna is, first of all, setting the stage for what follows. And then, you know, to show us the comprehensive nature of this entity that we're about to deal with in the form of dharma. And then he brings it a little bit more closer to the concern that Arjuna has, because he's trying to get the Pandavas to win this war. He's got a specific purpose. There are many different ways of interpreting Bhagavad Gita, but all of them agree that at the end of the day, Arjuna is going to fight. It's often said about Vedic literature or Hinduism in general that it offers infinite options about what you can believe, but no options about what you're going to do. You're going to do your duty, one way or the other. So Arjuna is going to fight, and Krishna wants that fight to happen, because he wants the Pandavas to win, and he wants Yudhishthira to be on the throne, because he knows Yudhishthira will keep this thing alive. Yudhishthira is a dharmic king. So therefore he's bringing it to this level, and we're going to hear tomorrow from Krishna, the Supreme Authority, on the various characteristics of the Brahmanas, of the Kshatriyas, of the Vaishyas, and the Shudras, and we'll say some more things, but I wanted to at least maybe dilate a little bit more on what's implicit in this text, and give you some sense of the scope and of the importance of this very, very subtle and profound, but too often evasive principle that we call dharma. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes.
Thanks. Prabhuji, you quoted the verse, there, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't it refer to standards?
But a standard is nothing but the injunction, is it not? I mean, a standard means what you're supposed to do, whether by custom or whether by injunction. It's a standard means, a niyam, a rule of some sort.
One of the reasons why I bring it up is there would be a confusion outside of India that, well, my forefathers did it like this. We would eat beef. We would do this. We would go hunting. So perhaps it would not be easily correctly understood if it has the same emphasis
on the forefathers' tradition rather than the Shastra tradition.
Yeah,
that's a good point. And in fact, that idea is in fact nourished by at least the Vamana Purana, I think it is. I think it's the Vamana Purana, I don't have to check. In which it's actually stated that those who are demons, their dharma is to behave as demons. So, you know, this is not the kind of thing that Prabhupada really talked about very much, is it? And for obvious reasons, even devotees we see, we twist and twangle what Prabhupada talks so often, isn't it? We have a field day with a concept like that. So, it's true, yeah, it's a dangerous thing to do that. But I think the way that I take this, at least, my understanding is that if we want to, you know, those of us who have been socialized in another religion, in another ethnic community, in another culture, you know, if we really want to assimilate Krishna consciousness, I mean, if we want to preach Krishna consciousness, that's predicated on assimilating Krishna consciousness, but if we really want to assimilate Krishna consciousness, then we've kind of got to take the whole thing, and we kind of have to convert to that step, to those standards which are pre-existing and which are not really malleable because they're taken as the eternal reality. Is that clear? There are many dharmas that are relative in their authority, but Sanatan Dharma is unchanging and eternal in its authority. And this is what Srila Prabhupada is teaching. The problem is that you have dharma that's manifest in the spiritual realm and it's also manifest in the material realm, and it's very easy to confuse them because they look alike, they walk alike, they talk alike, they smell alike, everything looks the same. So how do you tell them apart? This is why we have gurus. Or? Is that okay?
Yes, sir.
Is it complete?
No, I could just pursue it a little, because you mentioned taking the entire culture, accepting it.
Sarvam eta dhritam manye, as Arjuna said in the Bhagavad Gita. Dhritam, I accept everything that you've said as dhrita, which I mentioned earlier. Absolute, all-pervading, eternal truth. Otherwise, we tend to pick and choose what we want and we dismiss what we don't want, and that's, you know, that's a really nasty tendency.
I think my only little quibble is with that form pramana.
Yeah. What happens if you don't have a civilized tradition to draw
from? It's a bit like a doppelganger. It kind of muddies the water a little bit because the precedents, the tradition that we have available today is not exactly in sync.
It's not pure.
Right.
Yeah, period. Yeah, and I think that's probably why Prabhupada didn't emphasize it so much.
Right.
That's probably why. But if we're going to talk about dharma, we kind of have to emphasize it because, as I mentioned earlier, it's the locus of dharma. That is the only frame of reference that we have. Really, I mean, the Shastras are helpful in some degree, but, you know, it's like when you want to study music, I was mentioning earlier, you know. I mean, in my experience, any field of Vedic knowledge that I've studied, you know, the Shastras give these very basic skeletal kind of framework, and then the thing is really filled out by the Guru. So so it's certainly like that here. I mean, if you want to learn a musical instrument, you can really only go so far until you've got somebody showing you how to do it. That's the principle. You wanted to add something, Carla?
Oh,
give
an example outside India, actually inside India. We have so many regional differences, cultural differences. So I'm wondering, you're giving an emphasis that the locus is a society. We have so many societies.
So, yeah, especially in India. That's a very good point. It's a question that's often raised as well, because, yeah, India has had that experience for thousands of years, perhaps. And, you know, the Shastrakars, they recognize that multiplicity. And that's why it's very, very important to have an exegetic system or a hermeneutic system, a way to, you know, what we call Siddhanta very loosely in Krishna consciousness. Siddhanta. You know, a sense of what the conclusion is and how to get there. but, you know, a set of principles by which you interpret the information that you're receiving. There have to be some very clear, cohesive, and authoritative principles that allow you to process and, you know, classify intelligently, you know, all this multiplicity, which is staggering. Here in India, it's like, you know, down the street from where I am, there's a Tamil temple, and, you know, Sri Vaishnava temple, and you look at a South Indian temple, and it's just staggering, you know, all the different little guys running around, things happening on the wall of the temple. It's just, that's what this human life is like, and what to speak of the universe itself. I mean, it's characterized by this staggering diversity, and I think nowhere do we find that represented culturally as much as we do in the South Asian Peninsula. Now, one scholar named Aravinda Sharma has pointed out very astutely that with all the linguistic, religious, cultural, political, and, you know, otherwise diversity that Europe had, South Asia still had one thing that allowed it to retain a very fairly unified sense of self-identity, and that was Dharma. I mean, Europe fragmented early on and quite clearly, and, you know, they redraw the borders every once in a while. Now, of course, that people have given up Dharma in South Asia, the same thing is happening here as well. But, I mean, for a long, long time, this whole peninsula, this subcontinent, was held together by a fairly, unified sense of identity, only because of Dharma. And this is not just Hinduism, this is Buddhists and Jains as well, even Sikhs. They shared a lot of the same sense. That sense, what the yoga school calls dharmendriya, the sense, literally the faculty of perceiving Dharma, that's something which is often missing in those who are not socialized in this culture. So, to more directly answer your question, the Shastrakars say that when you have two smritis of equal authority saying different things and contradictory things, the best thing is to reconcile the difference with reference to a higher authority accepted by each, namely the Vedas, or some other smriti which is of a higher status, and there is a definite hierarchy. Other than that, they say, there is an option. If you have two absolutely identically authoritative scriptures saying contradictory things, then the conclusion should be that you have the option to do one or the other. And that's usually good enough. I mean, if you have really good mimamsakas, that is to say, people who are really, really know the Dharma Shastra and are very intelligent and very highly educated, they usually can make it work, and therefore they did for thousands of years. Even when the British came, they retained the original system of law. It's only when the British started toying with that system and introducing their own fundamentally different notions of, you know, for example, human rights and other such fundamental Western concerns, then the Indian law system began to get very confused and screwed up. Otherwise, you know, they have separate laws for the Muslims and they have separate laws for the Hindus, and they work remarkably well under the circumstances. apply to ISKCON? Well, if you think about it, we already have an ISKCON. You know, there's a staggering degree of diversity already in this movement. And there are many different ways of understanding Prabhupada's books and applying those books and in different cultural settings with different sets of assumptions and presuppositions. And, you know, it's just the world after all, isn't it? Therefore, you know, I mean, I would say that when Prabhupada gave us the order to cooperate in 1977, in his last days, he also gave us the system that will allow us to do that, if we understand it properly. And most of ISKCON's efforts at Varnashram to date, they have not been successful because the concept is not mature.
If we understand it properly.
Yeah, I mean, I would not say that we're anywhere near talking about any mode of application yet. We're still in assimilation mode. Now that takes a chunk out of the false ego to actually sit down and admit that. And especially for those of us born in America, like myself, or the West in general, and that includes Delhi and Bangalore and other modern cities here. I mean, you know, we have to admit that the way that we are socialized just predisposes us towards impiety. And that's also something that is not really very easy to admit. We have a huge disadvantage that must be overcome. We have to work harder at that. And there's evidence that in Prabhupada's Leelas, he actually had double standards. I'm thinking in particular one devotee, you know Smarahari from London. So he was explaining that he was in Kumbh Mela with Prabhupada in 1977, I think it was him. And he was saying that, you know, there was one Western devotee that did something that he wasn't supposed to do. And so, you know, there was an Indian devotee who did something he wasn't supposed to do, and Prabhupada chastised him severely for doing that. And then, you know, within a very similar scope of time, a Western devotee did the exact same thing, and Prabhupada was very lenient. And the Indian devotee who had been chastised saw this, and he was actually very disturbed by this. And he said, you know, I think he approached Prabhupada or somebody, he, you know, what goes here? I mean, he just blasted me for this. And Prabhupada said that they don't know anything. You know better. That's the difference. I mean, in those days, that was true. Nowadays, they're all asking whose father was Sita. You know what I mean? Whose father is Sita? In other words, they don't know anything about Ramayana. They think Sita is somebody's father. Prabhupada used that example also to describe modern Indians. Is that satisfactory? This is a very, very deep topic. It's a very subtle thing. It's a very deep thing. And, I mean, I try to urge everywhere I go that, you know, this thing is going to take some time. You know, we really have to. Going to take some serious work, particularly from, like I said, those of us who are socialized otherwise. It's a kind of retardation that we have in this realm. And unfortunately now, you know, because as I said, it takes just a generation of neglect, there are many Indians now who don't know any better. I know Indians that were born and raised in Delhi and don't even know how to speak Hindi. What to speak of who Krishna was. I've met them.